Der nächste Vortrag wird auf Englisch gehalten, so my introduction will also be in English. We are proud to introduce Roman Strobel of Sun Microsystems, who will talk about Open Solaris. I'm proud. Thank you.
So, good morning. My name, as my colleague said, is Roman Strobel, and I work at Sun Microsystems as a technology evangelist. Ich spreche ein wenig Deutsch, aber es ist wirklich nicht genug für eine technische Präsentation. Ich komme aus der Tschechischen Republik und das ist alles, was ich sagen kann. Okay. So, what makes OpenSolaris interesting? I'm going to talk about what actually OpenSolaris is, because I assume a lot of you haven't tried it yet even. And then I'm going to talk about how to use it on the desktop and really look at some of the interesting technologies like ZFS, D-Trace, SMF, IPS, and zones in action. If you have questions during the demos, you can ask. I will try to repeat the question so everybody can hear it. But I will also leave some time for the Q&A at the end. So first of all, let me ask you, how many of you use Solaris or OpenSolaris? Anyone in the room? Quite a few. Excellent. This is very good. That was almost one half, I think. What are the other folks using? Linux, I guess, a lot of people, right? It's like 70% or more, maybe 80. Windows, anyone? Also quite a few. Okay, interesting, interesting. A Linux conference with Windows people, Windows users. So, Macs? No, only a few. Some other operating systems, I forgot. OpenVMS, HP UX. Oh, yeah. So I see you are quite a mixed audience, so I'll try to focus especially on comparing with Linux, because that's what a lot of you use. And we will also look at how does OpenSolaris differ from Solaris 10, because I assume some of you also use that. So what is OpenSolaris? It is a new distribution made by Sun of the Solaris operating system. But as you know, Sun decided in 2005 to open source Solaris. But only last year, in 2008, we got the distribution, an open source distribution made by Sun. And it had two releases. The first one was 2008.05. I thought it was a sort of preview release because it had some bugs and so on. But the 2008.11 release is pretty good, and that's actually what I use for my work every day. And it's open source, free for download, free for commercial deployment even. But if you need support, if you are a company, you need support, you can come to Sun and we provide support for that. And the first time I saw Solaris, it looked like this. It was at the university. And I thought, what the heck is this? Why do I have to use this? And things have changed a lot. So OpenSolaris now uses GNOME, and it has all the different applications that you are used to have in an operating system, like Firefox, Thunderbird, OpenOffice, GIMP, and other open source applications. So it's very similar to Linux these days, I would say. So to explain what's happening is, we've been doing Solaris for many years. We actually started in 1982. That was the Sun OS for some of the older who can still remember. And that was renamed during the time to Solaris. And the last release that we have of Solaris, of the enterprise version of the operating system, is Solaris 10. It still receives continuous updates. It's very popular by large enterprises that really need a stable and long-supported operating system with a long cycle of support. But we saw, you know, Linux is really good in bringing new innovations, new features all the time, very quickly. And Sun saw that there is a need for also a fast innovating distribution. So we decided to do OpenSolaris together with the community. So we do OpenSolaris every 6 months, approximately. So we release every 6 months. And of course, this distribution has a shorter release cycle, shorter support cycle. You can get 18 months of support. For Solaris 10, you can get many years. We guarantee 10 years, but I think it's 12 years actually for some of the versions. So it's a really long support cycle. And so that brings a question, what should I use, Solaris or OpenSolaris, right? And I'll get to that. I would also like to mention that the upcoming version of Solaris will be based on OpenSolaris, right? So we'll take, once OpenSolaris is stable enough, you know, all the technologies are really finalized, we will build a new version of Solaris, probably Solaris 11, based on OpenSolaris. And maybe make some changes to make it look more like the traditional Solaris, include some more applications and things like that. But it will be based on OpenSolaris. So if you are a big company that requires a lot of support, long support cycle, use Solaris. That's the enterprise version. Solaris 10 is good, especially for large deployments on high-end servers. However, if you are a startup or a small company or just a developer, OpenSolaris is something you could look at because it always has the newest software and it's really, you know, the release is there every 6 months, so it's innovating quite fast. And if you are not interested for about what we do at Sun, there are also community distributions, right? So Nexenta is quite interesting, because it uses apt-get, the packaging system from Debian. Schillix, a German distribution. Some of you may know Jörg Schillix. And Sun still keeps crew developing the Solaris Express Community Edition, which is our way how to, well, it's like the Solaris, like the old way of doing things. So this is also still provided. It has updates every 2 weeks. And there are some other distributions. Bellinux is interesting for providing KDE. Milux has the lowest memory requirements, so you can run it on old hardware with 128 megabytes of memory. So there are some other options as well. Of course, these distributions are not supported by Sun, but they are supported by their own communities, except for the Solaris Express Community Edition that comes from Sun. And we expect more distributions to be created. Actually, I saw last week there was a new distribution created. So I think this will keep happening, like happened to Linux. But you have to think that, you know, OpenSolaris is a relatively new project because we open source Solaris just in 2005. So this takes some time. Now, Solaris has traditionally been used on the server. But we made a lot of changes and improvements to make it also usable on a desktop. And it can actually run on laptops these days reasonably well. So what you get, and by the way, I have some CDs here, only a few, so only those who will be fast will get them. So if you download OpenSolaris from OpenSolaris.com, you get a live CD image, right? So you can just boot it and give it a try. And if you like it, you can install from the live session. We bundle accelerated video drivers. We have agreements with NVIDIA, ATI, and Intel that we can redistribute their drivers. So this is legal. And we also use Compass and GNOME for the desktop experience. And some basic applications are included. If you need more, you connect to the package repository using the package manager or using command line and get more software. So let's take a look at OpenSolaris on the desktop really quickly because I want to focus more on the interesting technologies. Compass is integrated, so as you can see, you get all these different effects, visual effects. I guess this is what you already know from Linux, so this is very similar. To enable that, you go to Preferences and Appearance, and then you can set up what kind of visual effects you want to have. So over here in this tab, you can choose which of the effects you would like to have. Now, as for the applications, let me see over here. As I said, latest version of Firefox, Thunderbird, Evolution. As for multimedia, it's a little harder to get them there, but there are some packages for things like VLC and mPlayer, so you can get them from different repositories. Right now, they are not provided from the main Sun repository due to legal issues. So these need to be downloaded from separate repositories. Songbird is quite an interesting application. This is an iTunes clone that works pretty well. And also, you can get codecs for things like MP3 for free, but you can buy codecs for things like Windows Media from Fluendo.com. So, you can make it also a multimedia, like ever operating system, but it takes some work. One application I would like to highlight over here is the device driver utility. So, this is quite a nice tool. If you boot from the CD, you can run this from the desktop, and basically it scans. Oops, thing is dying. No, okay, it's back. Basically, it scans all your hardware and tells you if you have all the necessary drivers. So you can see that on my Sony Vaio laptop, I have here all the drivers except for the multimedia card reader. Well, actually, I haven't really tried to set it up. Maybe it would be possible as well, but I assume that drivers for multimedia card readers might not be there. And but for main hardware, we have partnership with Intel, so Intel hardware is really well supported. Intel writes drivers for us, NVIDIA drivers bundled, and a lot of different network and Wi-Fi cards are supported. So this is something I would suggest you to run if you want to check that your hardware will be supported before the installation. We also, I have it disabled now, but we also have this daemon that helps you connect to wireless networks and to Ethernet. So this makes it really easier to switch between different networks and just connecting to wireless, including protected wireless networks. Now, we've been also trying to integrate some of the Solaris technologies into this desktop. So one of the things that you get is the ZFS time slider. And I have here Nautilus, and over here, if you click on this icon, you can actually browse the history for any folder. So if I go back to, say, 16 days, you'll see I had a big mess on my desktop 16 days ago. And you can just take any of these documents or files and copy and paste them on your desktop. Or I can go, so I installed OpenSolaris 102 days ago. And as you can see, immediately after installation, I already downloaded a lot of software. So if I want to just get it back, I can copy and paste it. So this is based on ZFS. That's the file system in OpenSolaris. You can compare it to Apple's Time Machine. But this is better because it doesn't require an extra disk. So it's actually running on the disk I have over here, and only binary changes are saved. Now, this of course requires some more space if you're making these snapshots, but you can set them up on different file systems. So you can, for instance, have a file system for your documents and say, I only want to make snapshots of my documents. And then these snapshots will be taken automatically using the cron daemon, and you get basically backups of all your data that you want, and you can get back to them. It's really useful for things like source code, if you want to go back. I mean, we should be using version control systems, right? But this is really a lightweight way how to get some files back if you delete them by mistake and things like that. So I'll talk more about ZFS in details in a while, but ZFS is definitely one of the reasons I really like OpenSolaris. So ZFS. ZFS stands for Zettabyte File System. Zeta is 10 to 21. It's a really huge number, a lot of zeros. The capacity of ZFS is 1 billion of terabytes. So this is more than we can currently store on the whole Earth, like on the storage that's existing on the Earth. So I guess we need to get into space, build data centers into space, to reach the limit of ZFS, one file system, in terms of capacity. And ZFS really prevents silent data corruption, which is what happens when some application is, for instance, saving data to the disk, and there is some problem on the channel, on the DMA channel, in the driver, things like that. One bit can switch, and then you may lose some of your data. And existing file systems cannot really detect these kind of errors. And ZFS can detect that, and in some cases even repair. You get these snapshots. I'll demo them in a while using the command line as well. And you don't need to use a volume manager because ZFS uses a different concept. It's called the storage pool, and basically you just take as many disks as you like and put them into one pool, and then you can create file systems. And so volume management, I mean, there are good tools for that, but there are some disadvantages to using volume managers. For instance, in case of ZFS, if you're out of space, you just add, let's say, two more disks in the mirror, and suddenly the storage pool is bigger, and all your file systems have more space. So you cannot really do that easily with volume managers. You can add disks, but it will not enlarge all your file systems easily. You have to do manual steps to or reshuffle data and do things like that. Also, so it's easy to grow file system, and also disk access is much faster. If you have performance issues, you can just add more disks into the pool, and we will be striping across all these disks, which will speed up data access for you. And this is also easier to manage. So let's take a look at the demo. Now, I don't have any external disks over here or USB disks, so I'll be using VirtualBox, which is, if you don't know VirtualBox, it's something like VMware, but it's open source. And I have here four disks set up, so it's four 1 GB disks that I will be using for the demo. And here is the virtual machine. So if I look at zpool list, there are two commands for ZFS, zpool and ZFS. So zpool is for working with pools, and ZFS for working with file systems. As you can see, there is only one pool available right now. It's the R pool. That's the main pool, the root pool. And these are the file systems that have been created. Now, thanks to the fact that we use the pooled storage, you can see that all these different mount points, they have approximately 11 gigabytes of free space. So that means if one of the directories on the disk, if it runs out of space, if I put there too much data, you know, that can only happen once I'm completely out of data in this setup. So, for instance, I would say in Linux, if I would set up, you know, that var directory has 2 GB of possible space that it can consume, it may run out of the space, although some other mount points or some other directories will still have free space. So over here, we are really using the free space effectively. Now, let's take a look at working with zpool.
Let's try to create snapshots with only one hand. So ZFS snapshot. And if you could get the batteries, it would be great. So ZFS snapshot, and now I need to specify the name of the snapshot. So this is the name of the file system, and I use the @ to specify the name after that. So for instance, backup. So in 1 second, I actually made a snapshot which has 1.89 gigabytes in size. It's the whole snapshot of the OPT file system. Now, I'm going to run this operation, so check that it's correct. The presentation will be over, so let's try to delete everything in OPT. You'll see that deleting is the slowest operation if you work with snapshots and rollbacks. So it takes some time to delete all these almost 2 GB. And then I will try to recover the data. So my disk is spinning now. It seems that there is a lot of data in there. Okay. Now, I even had OpenOffice installation in there, so
a lot of useful applications and a lot of useful data was there. So I would like to show you that I really trust ZFS. And now I'm going to roll back. And so I specify again the name of the pool. And 1 second, and the data is back. So this is extremely useful, for instance, if you have a database snapshot in only 1 or 2 seconds. Yes. I think it's not working. Oh. And if you, the recovery of the data so fast, so 1 terabyte big database, it could take you hours to recover. Couple of seconds, so this is a really interesting feature. All right, so I'll move on to some other topics. So this was ZFS. It's right now it's available in OpenSolaris and Solaris. You can boot from it, even in a mirrored configuration. And ZFS is also these days available on Macs as read-write. And you can also get it on FreeBSD. In Linux, you can get it using the Fuse project. So the performance is not that great, but it also can work there. It's really interesting about OpenSolaris. It gives you a possibility to custom also the applications. And so this is useful for troubleshooting of software bugs, for monitoring what's going on in the system, measuring performance. And so again, I'll do a demo, and we have the batteries.
Perfect, thank you. So how many of you have heard about D-Trace? Anyone? Okay, quite a few. So let's take a look at a quick demo of D-Trace over here. So it's in my OPT directory. If the rollback wouldn't work, I would lose all my scripts here. And if I look at, this is like the hello world for D-Trace, right? So what I want to do is look at all the different syscalls, system calls that are happening. And when I enter the system call, I just want to print out what is the name of the process, what is the process ID and the function. And so, when you write D-Trace scripts, you use the D language. This is how it looks like. It's similar to C. Now, I should also show you, if you do D-Trace-L, then you see all the different probes. And so there is about 65,000 of probes. And there are mainly in the kernel, but also in applications. You can also use it for Java, PHP, Ruby, PostgreSQL, MySQL also recently added D-Trace probe, so you can also observe what's going on inside of the databases. And so if I run this simple script, what it's going to do is going to show me just the different system calls that are happening on the fly. So as I switch here, yeah, you can see this is what's happening in the system, different system calls that are happening. So this is not that much useful, but let's look at some more useful scripts. One of the problems that you can have on the server is that there is a lot of I/O happening, and you do not know which processes are moving the I/O. And so you can write or even download from somewhere such a little script, which basically what it does, it looks at all the different I/O, and whenever the I/O starts, it's going to count how many bytes have been moved, and puts it into this total variable. It also looks at the distribution, which means it gives us what is the most common I/O, what is the block size of the most common I/O. And then using this hash function, we can also use the name of the process. So I will count basically the bytes that are moved by different processes. And then we are going to print it at the end. So if I run this, and maybe run some different process over here. So this is a very data intensive process, find on root. And when I cancel this, oops. Oh, it's a wrong script. Dtrace QS tree count IO. Again. So I'll let it work for a while and then stop this. You can see that during this short moment, I moved about, 9 megabytes of data, or the system moved 9 megabytes of data. The most common block size was 65 kilobytes and or 64 kilobytes, and then Find was the application that was moving the most data, but also the scheduler was moving some data on the server. So you can simply run this script, and you can use Dtrace in production servers, right? So as long as you don't run the scripts, the server will not slow down because the probes is just one line of code. So it will not slow down. Of course, when you run some very complicated scripts, it may slow down the server, but it's up to you to evaluate, how much is going to affect your server. But this way, you can really easily find out what's going on, for instance, with I/O. And I would like to show one more script over here. Again, a very simple script. We are looking at syscall called open. So this is the open file syscall. And whenever we enter this syscall, we want to find out how many times, basically, the file was opened. And we are looking at Firefox. So this is like a predicate. This is like a condition. We want to only look at processes that are called Firefox bin. So dtrace.qs. Now, what I'm going to try here is try to run Firefox and see what does Firefox do on its startup. So it is starting now. And you'll see it's not completely ideal. So it has started. And when I break it, so you see Firefox is opening tons of different font configurations, libraries, lots of libraries. But at the end, we see also pretty interesting information that some of the files get opened more than once. So for instance, this file gets opened 6 times. And maybe, Firefox shouldn't do that. Maybe it should open it only once, right? Why do we need to open it 6 times? We just need to open the file once on startup. So you see that there is some space for optimization of Firefox. And actually, Firefox keeps getting better because in version 2.0, it would open some of these files 13 times and so on. So they keep improving. You can really use Dtrace to look at these kind of things. And I would like to show one more script over here. I actually compiled MySQL with Dtrace probes. So this is a little more complicated script, but I guess it's understandable. This is just a line deep print in the beginning of the script. And then we want to know basically how long it takes to execute different queries and what are the queries that are being executed and what is the database and so on, connection ID and things like that. So I'm going to run this one script. Okay, so now it's in interactive mode. And I'm going to open here shell. Connect to MySQL. So you can see that connecting took 200 milliseconds. Choose a database took 2 milliseconds. These are the different queries that are being executed by MySQL on background. And now let's try to, some aggregation function to make it more interesting. Select comment from big table. So, that takes 0 seconds. So there's an index for that or something. Where ID is bigger than 100. That should take a little longer. Okay, so here it tells us it's 2.06 seconds. And here we see it a little more exactly, 2055 milliseconds. So if you have a problem with your database, there's a lot of queries running, you don't have the logging set up, you can just use Dtrace, and not only for queries, for logs and for different things. I mean, it's up to your imagination what kind of information you want to get from the database. So this is also pretty useful. That was dtrace. Now, one other interesting technology is SMF, which basically replaced the RC script, which you may know from Linux or from some other operating systems. And it can also handle dependencies and fault management. So in my previous job, I was working on as a Linux administrator in a startup. And I would often get calls like 2 a.m. in the morning. My website is not running, right? So I would log into the server, restart Apache, and the website was running again. And so with OpenSolaris, this wouldn't happen because actually SMF will take care of dying processes and it will try to restart them. So the command, the main command is svcs or svcadm. So svcs is going to show us all the different process services. As you can see, they're using a special naming here. This is the name of the protocol and then some classification. And also we can have multiple instances of different services. So if I look at, for instance, you can also find a process ID easily, which is quite cool. So if you look at the initd service, you can find out what is the process ID of the initd process. And so every service remembers what are the different processes started by it. So if there would be 10 processes, you would see all of them. And so if I try to kill this one and run svcs again, you see there is a new ID. So even though I killed the process, it has been restarted by SMF because SMF takes care of restarting services in case they fail. And of course, you can configure this. So there is XML configuration. If you don't want this behavior, you can disable it. You can specify how many times it should try to restart it, any cleanup it should do, and things like that. Also, if you use dash x, you can find more information, including link to the log file where you can find out what happened. So this is, I mean, it's just a small thing, but it really helps on the server with reliability. The other thing that's in there is dependencies. So for instance, I can look at sendmail and I can see, well, maybe it doesn't have, there's no point in trying to start sendmail when there is no network or there is no file system. So you can also set up dependencies pretty easily. And you know, then you don't try to start up, you know, many different services for which there's no point in starting when, you know, the network is missing or something. And also it lets you start services in parallel. So that is now also possible with SMF. IPS stands for Image Packaging System. So we created our own packaging system. Some people don't like that because they say, you know, we should have reused Debian's packaging system or RPM's. The main reason why we created our own packaging system is to integrate it with different technologies in OpenSolaris like ZFS. So for instance, when you upgrade your OpenSolaris, snapshots get created automatically. So if you run the pkg image update command, you get snapshots. And once you boot your server or your machine, you can choose, do I want to boot into the new environment or the old one? Right? So in case the update would fail, instead, in case upgrade for some reason would fail, you can still go back. So you can just boot into the old environment or completely roll back. And imagine on Windows or you know, for instance, on Windows, if you upgrade your Windows, there's no way back. On Linux, I mean, you can go back, but it's complicated. You have to uninstall packages and things like that. Here, it's just a single command. And in basically 2 seconds or something like that, you are rolled back. And what's also interesting is if I look here at the snapshots, there is a special snapshot, grep install. There is a special snapshot that is created right after installation. So what you can do is roll back immediately after installation, right? So that's I actually tried that once, and it really does something very interesting because suddenly, you know, if you upgrade your system and things like that, if you install a lot of packages, they will be suddenly gone and a lot of things changes. So basically, it's an atomic operation, but your open Solaris completely crashes because you remove a lot of files which are being used by the kernel. But then you reboot and you boot into the status which was right after installation. So this is also pretty interesting. You can also use multiple images. So if you are building a package, you can just test it in a separate directory. You don't have to install into the main OS the package. Even if a single package installation fails, imagine you are installing a package and the electricity goes down. The snapshot is created automatically before any installation of a package, so you can again go back into the state before the installation. So this gives you a more reliable system. What's not so cool about IPS is that it's still evolving, so it's pretty new, and it still takes some time to stabilize everything. By the way, it's written in Python, so that could be interesting for some of you. And so expect this to still evolve a little, but as you can see, it's part of the distribution, and it can be used reasonably well. Also, we have now a lot of different repositories. So if you are a desktop user, you can install packages from different repositories. So the release repo is the main one that is pre-configured for you. But then you have the development repository, contrib, and pending. Basically, into pending, we put like everything. So we compile the whole SourceForge and then put packages there, test them if they are good, and move them up the level. So the quality goes up all the way to the release. So IPS, I guess really quickly, let's take a look at the package manager over here. So over here, we can set up different repositories. I have only the main one here and a local one, which I'm using for testing my new packages. And here is the boot environment management. So when you upgrade, I actually didn't upgrade from this version to a dev build, but I could still switch here and choose I want to boot into the old environment, which was snapshotted, you know, right before the upgrade. Or you can delete these environments if you want to get more space on the disk. Otherwise, the command for IPS is pkg, so man pkg. Pkg install is like apt-get install or yum. So that's installing from the network repositories. And finally, one last technology I would like to talk about is zones. So this is really useful for very lightweight virtualization, similar to BSD jails, but really well thought out. It took the concepts into their limits. So it has complete resource namespace, security, and failure in, isolation. But you run basically one Solaris kernel there, and you can have there like 10 different zones, for instance. Really interesting for instance, web hosting companies, because they can create a lot of instances of these zones, isolate individual instances, and put there many Apaches, for instance, or application servers. And for you who use Linux, it might be interesting to know that we have also branded zones, which basically let you run Linux applications on the Solaris kernel. So there is a mapping. And I would like to demo that. So I'm going to switch over here. So pfexec, by the way, is similar to sudo, but it's a little better than sudo. So over here, I have a script that is going to switch my network so that I get a local network here so that I can connect to the zone. Excellent. So I have now this IP address, and the zone will have a different IP address. So the command is zone ADM for working with zones. And I have a, if I do this, I will see list. If I do the list, I see different zones. So I see this is my global zone, that's like the main OS, but I also have a Linux zone here, which is a branded zone. Yep. I can start the zone. So zone ADM Linux zone boot. And so this is not going to boot like the whole OS. Actually, I'm able to log in pretty quickly to Linux Zone. So now I'm logging into, this is basically CentOS, some old version of CentOS. So if I do uname-a, I see this is Linux CentOS. It's pretty old, but fake Linux. And now, if I want to run, for instance, a Linux application from directly from my Solaris operating system, I have here another script. Pretty simple. It just connects using SSH. Because if you look here, this is Linux ifconfig eth0. I have this IP address. So I'm going to connect to it and run the application. So for instance, let's try to run Mozilla. So I didn't set up the keys. It's going to ask me for a password with SSH. So I specify the password. You can, of course, set up the keys if you don't want to ask for the password. And then Mozilla, Linux Mozilla is going to start from this zone. So as you can see, it's another application. It looks like another Solaris window, including the effects I have here. And if I look at about Mozilla, it really thinks it's running Linux, but actually it's the Solaris kernel that is under it. So this is a nice technology you can also play with. Zones are mostly used for Solaris, branded zones. I think it's kind of a corner case for zones, but most customers, actually most of the customers who use Solaris 10 use zones, for instance, to run all their Solaris 8 or 9 applications inside of a zone. So this is a pretty common use case. If you have to work with a Windows network, you need a good file server for Windows, a secure one. You can use Solaris or Open Solaris. We have SIFS supporting kernel. So basically, we have really fast file sharing with Windows inside of the kernel, which scares some people, but you can do that. And it has a lot of features that you expect it to have. So that's really useful for file servers. And another reason why to look at Solaris or Open Solaris is if you go to indeed.com, they give you what are the average salaries for different people. And if you look at senior Solaris administrator in New York, it's $103,000 per year. So you can compare with your salary and see if it's better or worse. But Solaris, generally Solaris administrators make more money than Linux administrators because there's fewer of them, right? So there's less competition. So it's harder to find people with good Solaris skills. So that's another reason why to look at Solaris. To get the bits, go to opensolaris.com for the distribution, get the live CD. And there is also a great new book, which is very heavy because it has about 1,000 pages. But it has everything in there, and it's really well written. So I recommend this book. You can get it from Amazon. If you want to get started, probably the easiest way is either using the live CD or install into VirtualBox, because then you don't have to worry about things like drivers. This is really useful for just giving a try. And if you install on your bare metal, make sure to check the drivers, as I mentioned, so that you know all the different drivers are there for you, and you don't get surprised that something doesn't work. And in conclusion, Open Solaris provides you with many different technologies, very interesting technologies, things like ZFS is now being booted by default. It's the main file system. No UFS. Well, you can still use UFS with Open Solaris, but it's not used as the default. Dtrace, really cool for observing applications. SMF for reliable services. IPS for packages, and Zone for lightweight virtualization. And we are making improvements on the desktop, so expect more on this. Actually, there is a partnership now with Toshiba, so you can get Toshiba laptops pre-installed with Open Solaris. So you can go to Toshiba and order these. That's pretty interesting that also, you know, we are getting Open Solaris on a lot of laptops. Questions? Do we have the microphone?
I think it's not working.
It's not working, so please shout if you have questions. Any questions? No questions, really? Yeah, okay. Performance in zones. That's a good question. It's very lightweight virtualization. The measurements show the overhead is about something like 2% of the virtualization, right? But you have to make your own measurement, I think, to compare. I think we are doing better than VMware in terms of, it's really the best for virtualizing Solaris. So for virtualization of Solaris, it's really effective. So around 2% like overhead. You had a question, please? It's based, so the time slider, as I'm using it, is making automated snapshots, like every day, there's an hourly one, depending on if there are any changes. So it's basically doing the snapshots, in some intervals, which you can configure using cron. For any file system, you can invoke the snapshot yourself, right? So you can also do that yourself if you want to have more frequent, for instance, snapshots, or less frequent, you can write a script yourself. But we are not tracking every single change, because then it would consume just too much data. You can also set up how much data should be used by this. So over here, this is the configuration. If you run this tool, then you can configure for which file systems you want to use the time slider, how much data should be reserved for the system, and things like that. Any other questions? Yes? For clustering of zones, I'm afraid I do not know the answer. Does anybody in the audience know the answer? Has anybody used zones in clustered environment? Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't tried that. So, any other question? By the way, I have here some CDs. If you want to get them, you can, if you are fast enough, or you can download, of course, it from opensolaris.com. And I would like to thank you for your attention. Thanks.